Writers Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, as usual, Monica Hadley, and with me, as usual, is my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Yes, yes. How is everybody? I'm hoping good in this crazy world.
Yeah, 2020. What a year. We were just talking. We've been doing this show for almost 14 years. It'll be 14 years in October. And this is definitely a different time. Luckily, we're able to do this all remotely, so nothing changed for that. Mom's down the road in Mount Pleasant, and our guest is wherever our guest happens to be, which we'll find out in a minute. Actually, do you have the information about our guest, or do I have that today?
Well, I have a little bit of it. Okay. It was just a very short bit.
Why don't you introduce our guest today?
Okay, our author today is Brady Hannes, he's a writer and documentary film editor, and he's written many short stories and have appeared in Michigan Quarterly Review and Landlocked, among other things, and he lives in L.A. by way of Colorado and Iowa. He lived in Iowa at one time. Okay.
And the author, all right. And the title of this book is The Resolutions.
Yes.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Brady.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
All right. So where in Iowa did you live?
So actually, both of my family is all from Iowa. So my parents both grew up on farms in southeast Iowa in a little town called Keswick and Sigourney. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
Well, considering that I'm sitting here in Fairfield, Iowa... Yes, I am familiar with that.
right. I figured you would be. Yeah. Most people are not, but yeah, being from Fairfield, I figured you would have heard of it. So they both grew up there, and then I moved around a lot, but for most of my childhood, and particularly during high school, I lived in Des Moines in a suburb called Urbandale. So I have a lot of connections to Iowa and a lot of very fond memories. And I go back there. I still have a grandmother who lives there, and then lots of extended family in the area as well.
Now, are you cousins by any chance with Adam Hammes?
You know, someone else asked me that. That's so funny. I don't believe I know an Adam Hammes, but he's a Hammes and from Iowa, I'm sure there's a connection somewhere.
He grew up in Richland, which is also Keokuk County, and so
I would bet that there is a connection. Yeah.
He was a guest on our show a while back. He wrote a book about sustainability in business in Iowa. And
it was wonderful,
really great. So you guys should get to know each other.
Yeah, we absolutely should. I'll make a point to reach out to him.
So, then Colorado, and where are you? You're living in L.A. now?
Yeah, so I went to college in Colorado. I was there for 4 years in a small little mountain town. And then after college, I moved to Los Angeles to work in the film industry. I studied film in college and then moved out there right afterwards in 2001 and have been out there ever since. So it'll be coming up on 20 years, actually, which is the longest I've ever lived anywhere. So it's sort of home, but I definitely consider myself a Midwesterner at heart, even though I've been in LA for the last 20 years. So, and at the moment, I'm actually in Boise, Idaho, speaking to you. My wife's family is from Boise, and so we are back here visiting a little bit during the summer.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Is The Resolutions your first novel?
The Resolutions is my first novel, yes. As you mentioned before, I've written short stories over the years, but this is my first novel, and it's been a pretty long process. I started writing it in, I believe it was 2011, and worked on it sort of off and on, you know, like a lot of writers, I have a day job. I work as a documentary film editor. And so, you know, I wasn't working on it full time, but I worked on it, you know, whenever I could find moments, and for about 5 years. And then once it was done, went through a couple rounds of revisions. I, eventually found an agent in 2016, and then I worked on it with her for about 2 years. She really helped me shape it even further. And then we finally sold the book in 2018, and then it came out in May of 2020. So it's been a long road, but I wouldn't say I've been necessarily working on it that whole time. You know, there were a lot of moments of downtime and whatnot.
Well, it sounds like that's a fairly typical timeline for a first novel, actually. You know,
I think so. I mean, I think we've talked
to writers who spent way longer, a few who, you know, wrote something really quickly and got it published really quickly, but that doesn't happen very often. It's usually a pretty long haul the first time.
Yeah, I think for most of us, you know, first time authors, you're really kind of learning how to do this as you go, and so there's a lot of starting over and backtracking. And I think, you know, as you get more books under your belt, you probably become a little more efficient, and or at least you are, you know, have a little more time to devote to it working full time, you know, as opposed to juggling other day jobs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to be able to do that going forward, working full time as a writer?
I don't know. We'll see how it goes. I mean, the great thing is that I actually really love my day job. You know, I work, as I mentioned, as a documentary film editor, which is really nice because, you know, there are actually a lot of parallels between writing and the documentary work. When you're editing a documentary, you know, you basically, because there is no script, unlike with a normal feature film, narrative film, you know, there's a script and you're following the script. With documentary work, the editor really is writing the film in the editing room, and you're taking, you know, this mountain of footage, sometimes hundreds of hours of footage, and shaping it into, you know, a coherent story with a shape and an arc. And so actually, you know, I really love that, and I don't think I would ever fully stop doing the documentary work. I think in an ideal world, I would spend, you know, a good portion of my time just focused on writing, and then just be really selective with the documentary jobs that I take. But yeah, it's great because there are so many parallels, and the writing informs the editing, and the editing informs the writing, and so it's a nice balance, I think.
What in your like childhood led you to get into documentary film writing or filmmaking?
You know, it's hard to say. I didn't really have any artistic aspirations as a kid. I was mostly, you know, just interested in, mostly what I was interested in was skiing, actually, and that's what took me out to Colorado.
Which is unusual enough for an Iowan.
right. Yeah, well, there's a few ski hills in Iowa, but they aren't much compared to Colorado. And so I went out there, you know, with few goals, artistic goals in mind, and then about halfway through, I sort of took a couple classes and started dabbling, and then you know, kind of went into the film program there, and then, you know, moved out to LA right after that. But I don't know. I've just always enjoyed creating things, and then and just telling stories. And for a while, I thought film was the way I wanted to tell stories, at least, you know, fictional sort of narrative stories. And I spent a lot of time in LA writing screenplays and trying to get little short films made. But the problem with that is that, you know, films are just so expensive to make, you know, and you're dependent upon a number of other people who all have to say yes, who all have to buy into your vision. And so at a certain point, you know, after writing screenplays and they're not going anywhere, it just occurred to me, you know, ultimately what I want to do is tell stories, and, you know, writing books seems like a more efficient and realistic way to do that, because, you know, I don't need a bunch of money. I just need my own time, you know? And so when I was around, you know, probably about 10 years ago or 12 years ago, I switched and started writing short stories, basically, and then the novel grew out of that. But as far as the documentary work, I just found that, you know, working as an editor, there's just something more fun about editing documentary work because, like I said before, you have such control over the story, and you really do become, in many ways, the writer of the film.
Well, your characters in the book, I mean, they're from the same family. They all have gone down separate paths, and that's interesting. Of course, that happens in families, you know. But you remind me kind of Gavin, the one brother who is an actor, and
right.
He gets involved in different productions.
That was definitely that thread of the story was certainly inspired by my time working in the film industry and some of my frustrations and disillusionment
with it a little bit.
It's not the most flattering portrait of life in the Hollywood machine, but that was certainly loosely inspired by my time in L.A.
Well, the other two characters, and let's just give a little background. The Resolutions is a story of three siblings, two brothers and a sister who grew up in the Midwest, but in Chicago, which is kind of different than Iowa, but except for the weather, it's similar. And the sister is a world-class ballerina. One brother is studying elephants in Africa, and the other one, as we just mentioned, is a not terribly successful actor in Hollywood. So we know where you got the kind of the details for the Hollywood brother, but how do you know, like, what life would be like for a ballerina or an elephant researcher?
Yeah. So as I said, you know, for as much as the Gavin storyline, I was able to draw from my personal experience, the other two required a tremendous amount of research. And, you know, to start with Samantha, the ballerina, a few years ago, I kind of unexpectedly found myself being rather drawn to ballet. And I just became a huge fan and started going to ballets with my wife. And so, you know, that the inspiration was just my own fandom. You know, I wanted to write a story about a ballerina, and then also just about, you know, a big part of the book is about people who I consider essentially like good people, but who have run their lives into the ground through mostly their own fault. And I'm interested in how that happens, you know, kind of slowly at first and then all at once. And so, you know, with her, she's also a drug addict. And so, you know, I wanted to kind of present this portrait of someone who is, on the one hand, like you said, a world-class athlete and incredibly accomplished, but, you know, through a series of sort of, first an injury that precipitates her downfall, she, you know, becomes like a lot of stories we hear nowadays, you know, an injury leads to painkillers and then leads to other things. And so, I wanted to tell the story of, like I mentioned, this incredibly accomplished girl who has lost her way a little bit. And then for the other storyline, Jonah, who is studying elephant communication in the forests of West Africa and Gabon specifically, that was actually inspired by a 60 Minutes profile that I saw, I don't know, probably 10 years ago. And that's actually based on real science that's being conducted out of Cornell University. It's a program called the Elephant Listening Project, and it's a team of behavioral ecologists who go out into the forests, usually in West Africa, and they set up these what they call autonomous recording units. They're basically like fancy tape recorders or digital audio recorders, and they plant them in the trees, and then they kind of leave and they record for days and days or weeks, and they basically just record the sounds that these elephants make, and then they take this audio back and they sort of sift through it, and basically they've been able to learn that elephants are incredibly They have this really sophisticated emotional life. You know, they have, they mourn their dead. They, you know, they feel sadness. They're just really complex and interesting creatures. And I was just so taken by this story that I kind of just dove headfirst into researching and learning everything I could. And, you know, I've also just ever since I was a kid, just really loved elephants and just thought they're just really magical creatures. And, yeah, so that was sort of the genesis of that storyline. And then again, you know, it was Jonas sort of gets himself into some trouble with these ivory poachers. And again, you know, he sets out with the best of intentions and then finds his work being sort of hijacked, and he gets in over his head. And again, like the other characters, kind of loses his way. And so I was just interested in that. And then the other part of the story I really wanted to explore is just the way sibling relationships kind of change over time. You know, these three characters were all very close, like most children. You know, when they're all living at home, you're in the same house, you're kind of bumping into each other, and there's this this proximity and sort of physical closeness that as you leave the nest and grow up, that sort of starts to disappear a little bit. And you know, especially if you're living in different parts of the country or even different parts of the world, as these characters are, there's this kind of slow drift that happens. And I wanted to sort of acknowledge that, but then also create or invent circumstances that would bring them back together. And that's kind of what happens in the book, is that they all reunite home in Chicago over the holidays, and then they're sort of forced to help each other kind of figure out how to write their crooked paths, I guess.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Brady Hamis, author of The Resolutions. Have you ever been to Gabon?
You know, I haven't. I've been to Africa. I've been to East Africa twice, and I've been to North Africa once, but that I was not able to go to Gabon. I actually consulted with the gentleman who is the director of the Elephant Listening Project, and he was incredibly helpful in terms of, you know, guiding me and explaining how they work. And I would, at a certain point, I sent him pages of the book for him to kind of read and correct anything I may have gotten wrong. And I really wanted to go on one of their expeditions, but, you know, space is so limited, and you know, these are people with PhDs and real knowledge, and they're just there wasn't space for a novelist who was just curious about their work. So I wasn't able to actually go. So I had to just rely on a lot of research, and then drawing a little bit from my travels throughout Africa. But you know, like I said, I never did specifically go to Gabon for that.
Okay, is it really? You mentioned several times, Jonah mentioned that female elephants are not growing the tusks anymore. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, that's funny you mentioned that. That's a detail that was added actually very late in the book. Believe it or not, my agent had heard about this. I forget, she read a news article about it and forwarded it to me and said, you know, isn't this fascinating? And I thought, yeah, it really is. However, the article was referencing savanna elephants, which are, you know, in East Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, and they're actually a little bit different than the forest elephants. They're usually bigger. And so, you know, I kind of wanted to work that in, but I wasn't sure it was accurate. And so I reached out to Peter, who, as I mentioned, was sort of a little consulting on this. And I said, you know, have you heard of this? And do you believe that this is possible? And he said, yeah, I have heard of it. He said, you know, we haven't seen it in forest elephants in West Africa, but he said, I have no reason to doubt that it's possible. And so that's kind of all the permission I needed. You know, I didn't need to know that it could happen. I just needed to know that it was plausible and it was not impossible that could happen. So it's a little bit fictional in that it's not necessarily happening right now with those specific elephants, but it is something that has been noted in research. And it's really interesting to think how they're adapting, you know, to protect themselves basically from poachers.
You know, how serious is the poaching and the ivory trade? Because I can't imagine anyone in the U.S. now buying ivory.
Right. It's not a problem necessarily, a huge problem in the U.S. Most of it is in China. And it's getting a little bit better, but it's still a huge problem. I think, you know, in China, the ivory is a kind of a status symbol. And with a sort of rising middle class, it's become there's been a higher demand for it. And I think, you know, people are getting the word out about how, you know, devastating this is for elephants. And so I think it's helping a little bit. But, you know, elephants, particularly forest elephants in West Africa, are incredibly endangered. And I read something recently that, you know, if something doesn't change drastically, it could be something like 20 to 30 years, they could be completely extinct, which would be really awful, obviously. But yeah, it's, you know, that part, sadly, is very much true and definitely happening all too frequently.
Some of these people that want ivory, they do realize that the elephant has to die before they can get the ivory, right?
You know, I think a lot of them do, but I've also read that there's a significant number of people who believe that they're like teeth or like fingernails, that they'll just grow back, you know? And so, you know, I don't know, you know, what each individual's motivation or knowledge is, but, you know, there was, I remember reading somewhere that there was a certain percentage of people who just thought, oh, well, they just cut them off and they'll just grow back the way your fingernail grows back when you cut it off. But,
wow.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
So, yeah. And unfortunately, it's not a very pleasant thing.
No.
And some governments in West Africa are maybe too corrupt to control the poaching.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. I don't think that's entirely it. I mean, I think a lot of the governments do realize that they really need to protect these elephants, that it benefits them. But, you know, you're also talking about just huge swaths of land, and, you know, it doesn't take much more than an individual with a gun, you know, to go out and kill an elephant. So there's only so much they can do, but corruption is certainly a part of it.
Wow. Now, Samantha was living in Russia at the beginning of the novel. Have you ever lived in Russia or been to Russia?
No, I haven't. You know, I have traveled extensively, but by the time I got around to writing this book, my life had sort of – so I traveled a lot when I was much younger and went all over the world, but by the time I got around to writing this book, I was getting married and then having my first kid, and so it wasn't as easy to just pick up and go to Africa or go to Russia. With Samantha's storyline, the Russia part, again, you know, a lot of research, but also that one, the location is less essential to her story. And really what I wanted to do was isolate her, not only, you know, emotionally, but, you know, geographically as well. And so I just figured, you know, this girl is struggling with drug addiction. It's just important that she's far away from everyone and that she feels very alone and isolated. And I thought, well, you know, ballet's huge in Russia, you know, set it during December when it's extremely cold and bleak. And, it seemed to suit sort of her mood.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Brady Hamas, author of The Resolutions, a novel. I have to ask, how many siblings do you have?
So I have two brothers. I have two younger brothers, but my mom is one of nine, and my dad is one of seven. And so I have a really big extended family, and, you know, part of it's, you know, drawn from my own experience with my siblings, but also part of it is just drawn from, you know, having this very large, rambunctious sort of a Midwestern family. And yeah, so.
Do you feel, you know, you may not even want to say this, but have you had to work through issues with your siblings that maybe made you want to develop this idea in a book?
Not on this kind of scale. I mean, the circumstances of all of the stories are very much fictional. You know, I wanted to, I'd always say, you know, my life is not nearly that dramatic or interesting to warrant a novel. But, like I said before, the real thing that was closest to me or that I really wanted to explore and that was based on my personal experience is this idea of the slow drift that happens when siblings, you know, flee the nest kind of, and how that distance kind of slowly happens. And, you know, it's not for, it's not because of a lack of love or anything like that, but it's just, you know, you have your own sort of concerns and, or eventually, you know, you may have a family or whatnot, and your priorities or your focus shifts from, you know, worrying about your siblings to worrying about your kids or your partner, your husband, your wife, whatever. And so, I wanted to, that was the thing that was closest to my personal experience. As far as, you know, all the other trouble they get into, that's just fabrication.
okay, so you didn't take your younger brothers on a, like, you know, seven on a bike ride on the highway to a pool hall or something?
No, that actually is a detail that is true. Yeah, I'm speaking more just about smuggling ivory into the U.S.
So perhaps you did have a party when you were a teenager with your little brothers upstairs watching TV. Yeah.
Exactly. Like those sort of more minor details are definitely the things that I pull from my own life. It's the overarching conflict that I guess is more manufactured. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, I say that, but, you know, I think I'd be lying if I said that, you know, I didn't pull from my own life, because I think every writer does to some degree, you know. But it's, strictly speaking, not a strictly autobiographical book about these events that happened, you know, in my young adulthood.
What do your brothers think of the book?
They both really liked it, actually. My middle brother just called me last week, I think it was, and he had just finished it and said he loved it. And my other brother, I sent him a copy. I sent him one of the galleys before the book was out, and he read it then. And they both really liked it. And, you know, I think like a lot of people, like a lot of writers, you know, you're always a little nervous about how people are going to take it, even though, you know, like I said, it's not strictly autobiographical. But, they both liked it. And my parents, thankfully, both liked it. So, that was good, you know. The family is still intact, so.
Yeah, it was interesting to me that you had this family, these siblings, having grown up in a normal household with loving parents, and yet they still, the lives were kind of gone astray, you know, a drug addict and a smuggler.
Right.
And I think we often just assume that if somebody's got a messed up life, it's because they had a messed up childhood. And
right.
As a writer, that's maybe the easy way out to suggest that.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I'm assuming this is a really conscious choice that you made.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're exactly right. And that's a really astute thing you pointed out, because I was very conscious of making sure that, you know, you couldn't just say that, you know, oh, well, these kids had parents who screwed them up or, you know, everything was stacked against them. You know, it very much wasn't. And they did come from loving families, and they still do very much love one another. And I think it's, I'm more interested in, like I mentioned before, just how, you know, no one intends for their life to go off the rails, but, you know, sometimes it just takes a couple of small missteps, and then those missteps lead to other things, and that leads to something else, and then before you know it, you've lost your way. And so, yeah, it was important that I that they come from a good family, and I also think that that's sort of also plays into the fact that, you know, they basically in the end sort of have to rely on one another to pull them out of their own individual messes that they've made.
Brady, would you like to read a little bit so we can get an introduction to these characters?
Yeah, absolutely. I will read from the first chapter. So the book is structured in sort of alternating chapters. Each chapter is one of the three siblings, so Samantha, and then Gavin, and then Jonah. So I'm going to read the first chapter of the book, which is Samantha's story. This is when she's basically stranded in Russia. So Samantha. She stood in a thicket of trees at the edge of campus, this place she now called home, a Russian dance company 200 kilometers northeast of Moscow. The sun hung low in the sky, dropping with the temperature, and her toes were numb from hiking through snow. She had been gone all afternoon, and now she was late for the dinner party, which posed a significant problem because prolonged absences didn't go unnoticed at a place like this. Nikolai, the director of the company, presided over his dancers with the omniscience of a cult leader, and Sam knew she would need a good excuse to explain her disappearance. Unfortunately, no one was buying her excuses anymore. Nikolai's father was a steel oligarch who had purchased the estate as a summer retreat for his family, but then the family stopped speaking to one another, so Nikolai claimed it for himself. He amassed a roster of choreographers and dancers from across the globe and hired a team of contractors to refurbish the grounds. He erected a dozen small cottages, little two-bedroom units the dancers shared, and commissioned a famous architect to design the studio space, a 3,000-square-foot glass cube situated amid dense conifer forest. Nikolai referred to the property as Chateau Oksana, named for his mother, but everyone else called it campus. Sam imagined it was the closest thing she would ever have to a proper college experience, probably not so different from those fancy private academies in New England. She slept in what was essentially a well-appointed dorm room, attended classes at a rehearsal space rather than a lecture hall, and took her meals in an upscale cafeteria. Even now, in mid-December, everything blanketed in a foot of snow, the grounds were impeccably groomed, the sidewalks brushed and cleared, the trees hung with decorative lights. There was an on-site staff to attend to the dancers' needs, nothing more than a phone call away, yet it was a suffocating kind of luxury, like being held hostage at Versailles. At the center of campus was the Grand Manor, a 10,000-square-foot palace that served as the social hub. She watched a procession of black SUVs unload passengers at the entrance, where Nikolai stood greeting a parade of sparkling men and women in formal attire. When he turned to kiss the cheek of an elderly, silver-haired woman, Sam made a break for it, sprinting past the rehearsal space and the gym and finally to her cottage. Once inside, she threw her coat on the bed and removed the small baggie printed with smiley faces. Restraint was not a thing she normally possessed in moments like this, but she was late and she needed to keep her head up through the party, so she stashed the baggie at the bottom of her sock drawer, a reward deferred. She moved to the bathroom and did a quick pass of makeup before slipping into a sleeveless black dress. She dabbed concealer on her forearm to mask the bruise, then looked in the mirror one last time, a woman with a question. Can you do this? Sam stepped outside and hurried toward the ballroom, her heels clacking against the sidewalk, her shoulders burning against the wind. She should have brought a coat, but her head was not clear, and when her head was not clear, she forgot things like coats. It had been 2 days since she'd gotten high, and that was a problem. Once a month, Nikolai threw a formal dinner party at the estate. He invited colleagues from the ballet world as well as friends from Moscow, mostly men who enjoyed mingling with the dancers. A few of the guests came for legitimate reasons, but most, the musicians, the minor celebrities, the baggy-suited hedge fund managers, came to gawk and make lewd sexual innuendos about first position. Sam found the events reprehensible, as if she were a part of a parade of dancing prostitutes. At the last party, she poured a glass of Chianti on the head of a sweet-talking investment banker after he put his hand on her butt and whispered stunning into her ear. After the incident, Nikolai placed her on an informal probation to ensure a similar embarrassment didn't befall another of his guests. Sam, however, made it clear to him that the best way to prevent future incidents was to instruct his guests to keep their hands to themselves. She had been summoned to tonight's party to meet a new choreographer Nikolai had recruited, though most of the names he'd promised had yet to materialize, so she wasn't expecting much. The two productions the company had mounted since her arrival had been savagely reviewed, which Sam attributed to their hack choreographers, one of whom was plucked from the Russian equivalent of Dancing with the Stars. The company's cachet had taken a blow in recent months, and Sam knew Nikolai needed a win as much as she did. She entered the hall and scanned the crowd. Her arrival had drawn little notice, and for this she felt a speck of relief. An old man was butchering Vivaldi on the piano, and tuxedoed waiters floated around the room with trays of hors d'oeuvres that appeared untouched. A few girls in tall heels and short dresses were huddled at the bar, cocktails in hand, chatting in a language she'd made no attempt to learn. She looked around the room, the crystal chandelier hanging from a 40-foot ceiling, the 19th-century watercolors adorning the walls, the Steinway piano. It was all somewhat surreal in its extravagance. The campus, the catered meals and personal trainers, even this dress she was wearing, a dress she hadn't paid for, but that probably cost more than most people made in a week, maybe a month. Her talent had shown her so much of the world, taken her so far. Chicago to New York, New York to Moscow, yet she still felt as if she'd been pulled into a terrible black void. So that's just the first few pages of Sam's story in Russia, and it sort of gives you a sense of how the sense of dislocation that she feels, and she's obviously, you know, in the depths of this drug addiction. But yeah, that's the first few pages of the resolutions.
Now you. Each chapter is from one of the siblings' point of view. And
right.
Is it consistent? Is it like Sam, then Gavin, then Jonah, Sam, Gavin, Jonah, or is it mixed up a little bit?
For the most part, it's pretty consistent. Towards the end of the book, the chapters get a little shorter because they're all in the same place, and it becomes a little bit like a relay, like they're kind of handing the baton off in terms of the story, and one picks up and then the other one. So, but for the most part, yeah, it's fairly consistent, and that Sam's first, and then we hear from Jonah in Africa, and then we hear from Gavin in Los Angeles.
And did the decision to write the story in that way, you know, from each point of view in separate chapters, was that a decision that you made right up front, or did that come as you started writing?
That was something that was there from the beginning. Yeah. The three individual stories actually kind of all started out as before I even knew that I was writing a novel. I had been writing them all as individual short stories, and then at a certain point it occurred to me, like, oh, these three characters could actually be related. Like they could be, you know, I could make them siblings, and then the book sort of grew out of that. But yeah, I didn't really have any. I'm not like a big outliner, and so when I'm writing, I kind of just start writing without really knowing where anything's going, and so I had no idea, you know, that they would eventually reunite back in Chicago, and then after that all three of them would return to Africa. That all kind of just came about through, you know, the process of writing and exploring, and then seeing, you know, where the connections were and how the stories overlapped. So, yeah, there was no grand plan at the beginning. It was kind of feeling my way through it, which, you know, I think probably for many debut novelists, that's kind of how you go. I think, you know, I'm working on a second book now, and with that one, I made sure to have a little bit more of a roadmap. You know, I wouldn't say it's strictly outlined, but I kind of learned that it's a little easier if you at least have a general sense of where the story's headed.
True. I think that a lot of authors today do use the alternating points of view. Mom, wouldn't you say that, mm-hmm. you know, a good number of the books that we've been reading have that?
Yeah, you're right.
Whereas in the past, it might have been more common to have had a, you know, a first-person point of view throughout the story, or an omniscient narrator.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
And
yeah, for me at least, you know, I think I've often thought about that because, like I mentioned, I'm writing a second book, and it is again about this time four different characters. But I think for me, I would have a hard time sustaining the momentum and the energy to just write about one character or from one voice. I think I found it easier to be able to switch back and forth from these different storylines that all ultimately come together. But for me, it was more interesting also too to be able to explore these different locales.
Well, these characters had, you know, because they all, like you say, you know, raised in a family and everything, but they went different paths, completely different paths, and so that was an interesting part of it, I thought. Especially because one ended up in West Africa, another in Russia.
Now, Jonah needed to go back to Africa after they met again in the States for his own reasons. I don't know if we want to say why Samantha wanted to go, because I wanted to ask you about her reason and what you actually know about that and how you researched that.
Right. I was curious.
You mean
about
the ceremony that she takes part in back in Africa? Yeah. So without giving too much away, ultimately, Sam, in an effort to rid herself of her addiction, goes back and participates in this, what's called an iboga, which is, again, a real-life thing originated in Gabon. And it's a spiritual ceremony that the native Bwiti people in Gabon do. It's almost like a rite of passage or something you do that marks your entrance into adulthood, maybe sort of like a quinceañera a little bit, but with a much more intense sort of experience. But it's also been shown to really rid people of drug addiction and specifically opium addiction. And so that part of the story came to me when I saw a short documentary about it. And at the time I saw it, I had, you know, I had my three characters, I had their sort of stories, I knew what their issues were, I knew that they were going to reunite back in Chicago, but I didn't know where the story went from there. And I was really kind of stuck for a long time. And then, like I said, I saw this documentary about, these people who are struggling with opium addiction taking part in the ceremony. And it just turned out that the ceremony originated in Gabon, which was where my other character was already doing his research. And I thought, aha. And it was sort of the moment when it all kind of unlocked and came together. And I go, oh, this is perfect. I can have, you know, her go back for this, you know, Jonah being there and sort of knowing a lot of the people, he would be aware of this. And the stories, it was just this sort of happy accident that, again, I had not planned on and I hadn't foreseen, but just a really sort of a nice intersection there.
I really wonder how you would have resolved the issues that these characters had without that.
Yeah, I don't either. there may not be a book if it weren't for that. And then, with Gavin, he's kind of the only one who doesn't really have a reason to go back. But I've also, he's portrayed as the eldest brother and a little bit of a, not bossy, but he's kind of a nurturing figure. And so, you know, I had this idea of, well, he's sort of lost everything. He has no job. And so he's kind of just going because he doesn't trust his little siblings to handle this on their own. And so he goes there thinking that, you know, he'll be the wise elder who will, look after everything. And he ends up being the one who gets sort of in the most amount of trouble and is, you know, he thinks he's going to go there to help his sister. And in the end, you know, he doesn't really do much of anything and she's forced to figure it out on her own, which I think in my experience, you know, my limited experience with people struggling with addiction, you know, that's kind of the way it goes, is like no one's going to do it for them. You know, you're going to have to figure that out on their own. So,
well, he has an idea that he might have been responsible for her starting with this way back, doesn't he? Kind of blame
right,
himself.
Right. Yeah, I kind of planted that seed as well. I wanted to sort of maybe, you know, suggests that, you know, while he's not directly responsible, the way siblings can influence each other when they're younger,
uh-huh.
you know, and
yeah.
and the
yeah.
way that, you know, things you say or do in an effort to, you know, make yourself seem cool can sort of have lasting impressions on, you know, your siblings who obviously look up to you and whatnot. And so, yeah, that was another aspect that I was interested in exploring.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Brady Hammes, author of The Resolutions. Where's that title from?
The title, interesting you brought that up, because that was not the original title that I started with. So the book, when we sold it, was called The Bygones. And it was sort of decided in-house that that wasn't probably the best title. And so we spent a long time sort of brainstorming different titles, and, you know, it took a long time before we finally got here, but I came up with this one. This was one that I suggested, and everyone seemed to like it, and it worked because, the book takes place around the holidays, and actually the last day, the book culminates, the last chapter of the book takes place on New Year's Day. So there's the idea of, you know, New Year's resolutions. And then, and there's also these characters resolving to try and, you know, put their lives back together. And so it works on a couple different levels. And I'm really happy that my editor pushed me to, you know, think of a new title, because I do think I can't imagine another title. It seems very fitting for the book.
No, it does. It's perfect. Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Now, I'm looking at your website, Brady, which is bradyhammes.com. Pretty pretty straightforward there. And it talks about you had an Emmy Award-winning documentary.
Yes.
Tom versus Time. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. A couple years ago, I was working on a documentary project about Tom Brady, the former New England Patriots quarterback. It's a 6-part sort of series, so it's told through episodes, and originally premiered on Facebook Watch, which is Facebook's sort of original content channel. And it was a really fun project, and just happened to win an Emmy, which was great for all of us. And you know, it was really gratifying to work on that project and then to see it find some success. So, yeah, I've somehow, as I've been editing more and more, I've found myself doing more and more projects based on sports personalities and whatnot. And so that was the first one. And then more recently, I was working on, actually up until March when the Olympics were canceled, I was doing a documentary on Simone Biles, the Olympic gymnast.
Yeah.
We were tracking her whole sort of road to Tokyo. This was going to be her last Olympics and her final hurrah. And it was a really fun project. Everything was going really well. And then COVID hit, and then the Olympics were canceled, and the project came to a screeching halt. So we're hoping to pick it up next year. Supposedly, I believe the Olympic Games are going to be next summer now in 2021. So hopefully the project will finally make it out to the world, but it's been delayed somewhat indefinitely.
So I assume they'll still be in Tokyo if it's going to be next year. And will Simone still want to compete?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, she says she does now, but, you know, for Olympic gymnasts, I think she's 22, which is very old, you know? And so she was already going to be the oldest one this year. And so she'll just be a year older next year. So as of now, I believe her plan is to do it, but you know, who knows what might change. So if, of course, if she doesn't do it, then there won't be a show. So.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And what was Social Animals about? That was another film you worked on.
Oh, yeah. So that was a documentary I worked on probably 2 or 3 years ago now. It's about Instagram, basically, and more broadly about how social media affects teenagers. And that one is actually interesting because there are a lot of parallels to my film. It's also told, it's three different stories about three different teenagers and their relationship to Instagram and social media. And it's, again, these three disparate storylines. They don't ever really come together, but they all speak thematically to the same thing. And so, again, that's just another example of how there are so many similarities between the writing and the documentary work.
You know, someone should do a documentary about seniors getting on social media.
There you go. That's an idea right there.
It is. Because Mom, Caroline, who just turned 85, just got on Facebook in the past few months. And
okay.
Yep. And yeah. So it's been an experience, hasn't it, Mom?
Yes, it has.
Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, but I spend too much time on it.
I think everyone feels that way.
Yeah.
It can become very unhealthy, especially during years of elections and whatnot. If you have a lot of people with differing political opinions, it can become a slightly toxic place. I personally try to avoid it as much as possible, but you know, I think.
Well, I don't pay too much attention to that. Most of my people are. I'm actually, what I really enjoy is connecting with some of my cousins, whom I haven't seen for years and years and years. My mother was in a family of nine, and so some of these cousins. Mm. I mean, that's what I really enjoy is that part.
Yeah. No, it's great for that. It's great for keeping in touch with people you might not normally see.
Right.
And in this day when, you know, Mom is pretty much isolated in her home, it is a good way to stay connected, even with, you know, some of your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids
mm-hmm.
that you're able to see right now. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love the pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Brady, before we run out of time, let's talk a little bit about your path to publication. You mentioned that you found an agent in 2016 and sold it in 2018. So that's a fairly long time for an agent to be working on a first novel. And how did you find your agent, and how did you keep them?
You know, the process of the book was, you know, I always tell people it's like it's not an easy process. And, you know, this certainly did not happen overnight at all. I think the book was rejected by somewhere between 30 and 40 different agents who either said no or just didn't respond until finally I was actually at a point where I was kind of really defeated and about to give up. And I just said, well, I'll send it to the last, like, two or three people on my list. And if nothing comes, then I'm going to put the book in a drawer and I'm going to try again. And I sent it to my agent at the time, Emma Sweeney, who just recently retired this past year. But I worked with her up through the sale of the book. And she read the first 10 pages and said, I love it. Can I see the rest of it? And so I sent it to her. And she actually called me and left a message. I was at work and said, you know, I love this book. I want to represent it. And she was just so enthusiastic about the book that part of me was like, are you sure you had the right book? You know, because a lot of other people said no.
You didn't actually say that to her, though, did you?
No, of course not. But I was like, you do? You know, like, you love it? Really? Okay, great. She was like, I love it. She's like, it still needs a lot of work, so don't think we're done. And so she sent me, you know, like three or four pages of notes, and I spent a couple months working on it, and then I sent it back, and she sent more notes. And this went on for a really long time, and at a certain point, you know, I kind of thought, like, is this ever going to happen? And, you know, like with agents, you know, they don't get paid until they sell the book. And so I thought, gosh, this woman is spending a lot of time on something that may not even happen. So, you know, I never really questioned her because she's such a seasoned pro. But part of me was like, is this ever going to happen? Because like I said, it had been almost 2 years and we were still working on the book. And then finally in February of 2018, she said, okay, I think we're there. It's feeling really good. And she said, I'm going to send it to five or six editors, and she sent it out, and my editor at Random House at Ballantine got back the next day and said she'd started it and was loving it, and then said she'd read it over the weekend and get back to us on Monday, and then she on Monday she'd finished it and said she loved it and wanted to talk, and so we talked on Tuesday, and then we had an offer on Thursday. So, you know, after, like I said, after being rejected 40 times and working on it for 2 years, then the book sold in less than a week, which was like just crazy. It was just a whirlwind. And it was really wonderful. But
and what did you do to celebrate?
Oh, I was at work, actually. I was working, funny enough, I was working on the Tom Brady project, and I was in my little edit bay, and I couldn't believe it. I went outside and I think I just yelled it to the sky, like a yell of joy. Cause I was just so like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. You know, it'd been a dream of mine for so long. But yeah, I mean, it's just, I think it's a testament to just perseverance. And, you know, you just have to believe in your own book and believe that someone else is going to respond to it as well. And, like I said, I'm so glad that I didn't put it away, because I was really close, and all it takes is one person to be really enthusiastic about it, and that's all you need. You know, you need an agent to say yes, and then you need an editor to say yes, and I was very fortunate that happened.
Yes, you were. That was wonderful. Oh my gosh.
Well, we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us here today, Brady.
Well, thank you both for having me. It's been a real pleasure, and I've really enjoyed it.
And Mom,
too. Looking forward to your next book.
Yeah.
Thank you. It actually takes place in Iowa. So. Yeah.
Where in Iowa?
Well, it's sort of loosely inspired by stories that I've heard from my parents and their family. So it starts out on a small farm in southeast Iowa, a fictional town. But it branches out from there, and it's much larger in scope. So it starts out in 1965 and goes through 1985. So. It's a sort of an attempt to make sense of our current moment by looking to the past, just because I think there are a lot of parallels, especially right now, that we're seeing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's, you know, I wanted to write something contemporary, but I didn't want to just write about a former reality show president or whatever. And so I felt like by giving it that distance, you know, you give him, what's the Oscar Wilde, give a man a mask and he'll tell you the truth kind of thing. By creating it, by setting it in the past, I felt like it was a more liberating way to sort of get at our current moment. So, yeah, but I'm hoping to have it done soon. So I'll keep you posted.
Thank you. And Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
Yeah, this is, I thought of this when I was, you know, reading this book. Life can take you down many paths, sometimes into trouble, but at the end of the road, sometimes we are blessed to return to family and their love for us. So sometimes you can go home.
That's lovely. Thank you.
Thank
yeah,
you.
That's great.
And thank you, Brady, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye.